Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's testimony by Attorney General Sessions before the Senate Intelligence Committee and speak with Lisa Graves, the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and a former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department. She joins us to discuss Sessions' stonewalling as he easily answered softball questions from Republican senators, but dragged out his answers to probing questions from Democrats to run out the clock by either pretending not to understand the questions or answering a question not asked. We will assess how theatrical Sessions' indignation was when confronted with his stonewalling and the Attorney General's assertion that he could not speak about what he discussed with President Trump on the grounds of executive privilege, even though Trump himself has not invoked executive privilege. Then we will speak with Russia expert David Satter, a senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and author of The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. We will discuss his latest article at the Wall Street Journal, From Russia with Chaos, and analyze the impact of the demonstrations that took place across Russia on Monday's national holiday, in which young Russians, some in high school, were roughed up and arrested by riot police, and assess what this means for Putin's open-ended rule into the future. Then finally, David Michaud joins us in the studio. He is the writer-director of a new film starring Brad Pitt, War Machine, now out on Netflix, that is based on the Rolling Stone journalist Michael Hastings' book, The Operators. We'll discuss his satirical dark comedy set around the downfall of the former commander in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, and on a day when the Defense Secretary General Mattis testified to Congress that, quote, we are not winning in Afghanistan, and that a new strategy will emerge in mid-July. We'll examine why, after 16 years, we keep doing the same thing in Afghanistan, yet expect a different outcome. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, who is the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Thanks, Ian. I'm happy to be on.
And you watched the testimony by Attorney General Sessions today. I caught a bit of it. I was in and out doing other stuff. But my impression was that it was kind of a waste of time. He just kept denying stuff, and all the important questions that needed to be answered, he wouldn't answer on the basis of protecting the executive privilege of the president. But at the same time, the president himself has not invoked executive privilege. So that was a pretty thin read, but it looks like that was what he got away with.
Well, I do think that Attorney General Sessions obfuscated at that hearing. He was, in my opinion, dissembling. He was evasive, and he made sort of the extraordinary assertion of executive privilege for the president before the president has even asserted it himself, in sort of a pre-executive privilege. And also kept trying to dodge by asserting policies that are not in writing at the Justice Department about what he could or could not testify to. I think that his testimony was literally incredible. And by that, I don't mean great. I think it was literally not credible, including the part where he was asked about the fact that even though he signed off on the memo against Mr. Comey, and the president subsequently admitted that that was not the real reason why he fired Mr. Comey, that he fired him to get out from under the Russian investigation into the Russian situation. Attorney General Sessions would not even describe his reaction to that concession by Trump. And so I think overall it was an obstruction of the congressional investigation. I think he was evasive. I think that he demonstrates yet again that he's not fit to be the Attorney General of the United States. If he wants to be Mr. Trump's private lawyer, then he should go do that job instead.
So do you think that he tried in any way or succeeded in any way? Because we know the situation is now. It's a he said, she said. Comey basically saying Trump's a liar, and Trump is saying that Comey's a liar. So did Sessions move the needle on that issue in any way?
I don't think so, but, you know, Sessions tried to claim that he agreed with Mr. Comey that that procedures should be followed that would prevent the president from talking directly with Mr. Comey about the investigation, and yet Mr. Comey testified that Sessions was basically noncommittal, in essence that he basically shrugged when he was asked to help protect him from that sort of interference. And then, of course, ultimately, just weeks later, after that conversation in which Comey described the inappropriateness of those sorts of intrusions by Trump, Sessions was happily going along with the Trump administration's, Mr. Trump's desire to get rid of Comey. And so I think that, you know, there will certainly be some in the right-wing media that will say again that Trump was vindicated by the testimony, invent another fiction, as they did after Mr. Comey's testimony, that supposedly Trump was vindicated. The reality is that what Senator Sessions, now Attorney General Sessions, proved was that he is in fact not really up to the task of being the Attorney General of the United States, of being at the top law enforcement officer of our country. He's someone who has shown his loyalty to the president over loyalty to the rule of law. And so on the right wing, I'm sure there'll be praise for his so-called testimony, but I think that most observers looking at that hearing this afternoon found him to be, would find him to be completely unhelpful, evasive, and really a loyal stooge of Trump.
Well, the fact remains he is the Attorney General of the United States, and even though he appears to be completely unqualified, he is doing an awful lot. He's probably making more changes that are long-lasting and more impactful than Trump himself is doing.
Well, I think there's a contest about the damage done, but there's no doubt that Mr. Sessions is in some ways wreaking real havoc on the Justice Department, on its priorities, on sensible practices in terms of how to proceed in a number of areas, including in the Civil Rights Division and more. He has a personal obsession as well with trying to, I guess he wants to personally prosecute the folks in business in California or Colorado, in the medical marijuana or marijuana distribution business authorized by the states. Meanwhile, his budget, the budget that he, through the president, submitted to the United States Congress, slashes funding for intervention on opioid abuse and other programs for local law enforcement assistance grants and more. He's just really demonstrated time and time again that he's willing to go along with whatever Trump wishes. And he obviously is the Attorney General of the United States until he resigns or is removed from office. And he is someone who, you know, in a sort of one of the most shocking moments of the hearing was his, you know, actual lack of curiosity, lack of interest in the fact that the 16 intelligence agencies have come to the conclusion and came to the conclusion last fall that there was an attempt by Russia to interfere in the election, the presidential election. And since that time, there's been just mounting evidence of the level of intervention that was pursued, a topic that Trump is apparently not interested in because of a variety of reasons people can speculate about, and that the Attorney General of the United States has shown little interest in himself, has not sought a briefing on, and meanwhile has aided Trump in getting rid of the man who was leading the investigation of Mr. Trump. And I think that that bodes poorly for the rule of law in this country. I think that it's a very dark day for American justice in this country with the statements and omissions by Mr. Sessions.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. She served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. Now, in terms of the story that broke yesterday from Christopher Ruddy, the Chief Executive of Newsmax, a friend of Donald Trump's, who floated the idea that Trump might fire the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller. Do you think that rumor was put to rest today?
I'm not sure. You know, in the morning's testimony before the Judiciary Committee, there was a statement by the Deputy Attorney General about standing behind Mueller. I think Mr. Sessions, was equivocating on that point. And quite frankly, I'm not sure that anyone could rely on his assurance no matter what he said. As Senator Jack Reed pointed out, last year Senator Sessions praised Mr. Comey for the very acts he later cited as the fake basis, the pretextual basis for aiding in his termination. And so, you know, I think it remains to be seen. You have a situation in which someone who's part of the right-wing media fake news environment, which is Newsmax, who's a buddy with the president, has tried to plant seeds of mistrust about Mr. Mueller. And you also have Newt Gingrich, who's another confidant of the president, turning course literally within the matter of weeks from his praise for the appointment of Mr. Mueller to suggesting that perhaps he should be removed. And so these are all signs that there is tremendous discomfort at the fact that there's a professional leading the investigation of Trump, of his potential, and I would say, in my view, certainly substantial evidence of his obstruction of justice and efforts to do so, and that there's concern by the right wing that Trump will be determined to have violated the law in numerous instances. And so I'm not sure that anyone's out of the woods in terms of whether Mr. Mueller will stay on in this role in this investigation, whether they'll attempt to remove yet another leader of an investigation into Trump.
So what did you make then of the testy exchanges, Lisa Graves, between the Oregon Democratic Senator Ron Wyden and Sessions? Sessions obviously at times got visibly angry.
Well, I've seen Senator Sessions turn on his anger at will. You know, when I was working on the Senate Judiciary Committee, he's in my view, theatrical by nature. He's someone who uses his sort of southern drawl and his cadence and tone to try to, you know, I think use his anger to manipulate people. That's certainly my personal observation of him. So that didn't surprise me. I thought that Senator Wyden's comments were exactly right. It doesn't smell right. It smells what's going on. It stinks what's going on. And Senator Sessions' responses were, you know, not, I don't think they were forthcoming, and I think that they were in service of the president over the rule of law.
Well, I think the takeaway statement was, I'm not stonewalling. And what was today about if it wasn't about stonewalling?
Right. It was funny. Someone said perhaps the rejoinder might have been, I'm not Stonewall Jackson, the famous general from the Confederacy. This is obviously stonewalling, and in many instances, Senator Sessions tried to filibuster his answers to these members, knowing that they only had one round each of 10 minutes. He sought to draw out his answers to try to, I think, limit the number of questions that he could receive. He was obfuscating. He was stonewalling. And I think the exchange with Senator Harris from California also revealed that he was not interested in providing yes or no answers, clear answers to clear questions, but instead was desiring to slow things down and make it very difficult for these members to get answers to their questions, unless they were Republicans throwing him softballs that he, you know, was eager to try to answer and shape.
So I think that was quite detectable when he was getting all the friendly answers from the good Christian Senator Lankford and Tom Cotton and others, that he didn't play that same game where he kept asking the Democrats who were asking questions, probing questions, could you repeat that? I'm sorry. And then he wouldn't answer it. And then it was pretty clear that he was dragging the clock out.
I think that's right. And also this invention of this sort of, I will provide an appropriate response is a non-response, quite frankly. That's no commitment whatsoever, as one of the other senators nailed down. There's no legal standard for what that means. Mr. Sessions would not really reveal any legal documents that he consulted with in terms of what the legal standards were for his testimony before going forward before this committee and asserting this sort of blanket he'll review and provide appropriate answers to anything. I doubt that they'll get much of anything from him, given his effort to to pretend like he's being responsive while actually preserving a basis that he's inventing and asserting to not be responsive by claiming he'll answer with whatever's appropriate, which could be nothing, in response to their questions. So I think that he revealed again, yet again, his partisan stripes. And many of the senators on that committee, the Republicans on that committee, revealed their desire to protect Trump at virtually any cost, which is quite astonishing given the mission of that committee in Congress, which is to have oversight over the intelligence community of the United States. And that intelligence community has been unequivocal, quite clear about the fact of Russian attempts to intervene in our election. And yet many of the Republican members of that committee seem more intent on protecting Trump and more intent in protecting even Sessions from the consequences of aiding Trump in obstructing the investigation, the criminal investigation involving the Trump campaign. And now, perhaps given the obstruction of Mr. Trump in that investigation, an actual criminal investigation into Mr. Trump for his behavior in firing Mr. Comey and more.
Well, just in closing, as you probably noticed, Lisa Graves, there was this ridiculous North Korean-type cabinet meeting that took place yesterday where every member of the cabinet praised their great leader, Donald Trump, in disgusting and sycophantic ways. And then, of course, at the end of it, the round of going around the big table, Trump himself then told everybody how great he was to sort of put icing on the cake. The only person who didn't praise him profusely was the Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, who praised the men and women in the armed services out there on the front lines, who Trump doesn't seem to give a damn about. He's only concerned about his own skin. So I thought that he basically ordered Sessions to do that as a part of ordering these guys to praise him. So what's your sense of what went on behind this? Why did he testify and what was the motive? Because it looks as though the whole thing was a waste of time, so I don't know why he did it.
Well, I think part of this is the stage management of this administration. It's basically we're living this sort of real-world experience of having the celebrity apprentice in the White House, and this is part of their effort to try to tell their increasingly smaller number of followers and fans that everything is fine and this is merely persecution. And so part of it is just the stage management that this administration is. I think they're in full throttle damage control to try to deal with the aftermath of Mr. Comey's testimony, very credible testimony last week, and the display that they put on yesterday in the cabinet, which was sort of like a cabinet of clowns for a clown emperor, telling him that he had, even though he had no clothes, that his clothes were resplendent and amazing and glorious. I don't think we've ever seen a display like that from a cabinet, a sitting cabinet in the United States of America. It was echoing of the type of displays that a dictator might seek from his loyal entourage to praise him. Numerous statements that Mr. Trump gave at that press conference that was held as a guise for this, the guise of this cabinet meeting of fawning praise for Mr. Trump. I think that many of his statements were false, demonstrably false, more lies from the president, more lies from Mr. Trump. And, I think that many people had the reaction of watching that it was a surreal farce to see this make-believe thing. But it's consistent fully with the effort of Mr. Trump and his closest allies to try to present an image of his supposed amazingness and decisiveness. Even his daughter yesterday was on Fox and Friends making similar assertions of the incredible success of his trip, his first foreign trip, and doing so in a way that just disregards the actual reactions of most of the people who observed it, including our allies in Europe, who were appalled by the conduct of Mr. Trump. And so, this administration, its proxies, including Mr. Sessions, including Ivanka Trump, are out there to try to pretend that everything is well. And as someone wrote in the Washington Post, in some ways this was almost like an enactment of King Lear, where everyone is trying to curry favor with Mr. Trump by praising him falsely, but to try to curry his favor, to try to get in his good graces. And that's because, in part, I'm sure they know that he's a vainglorious man who basically needs and demands their praise and demands their loyalty as a condition of their continued role in government, our government.
Well, I thank you for joining us. Lisa Graves. I won't say I'm blessed by your participation, but I'm thankful. And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who is the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. She served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back analyzing the impact of the demonstrations that took place across Russia on Monday's national holiday, in which young Russians, some in high school, were roughed up and arrested by riot police. Yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah? Baby, why don't you tell me the truth now? You know you got me going everything crazy that you want me to do. Yes, you have, yeah, watch it. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Satter, who has written about Russia for almost four decades. He is a senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and his previous books include Darkness at Dawn. His latest book is The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. And he has an article in today's Wall Street Journal, From Russia with Chaos. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Satter.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be with you.
And David, what did you make of the demonstrations yesterday on a national holiday across Russia? What was so evident about them was from the police, you know, rather roughly and sometimes brutally arresting the demonstrators, was that so many of them were incredibly young, including high school kids.
Yes, that's very significant. It means that the young people in Russia have not made the same kind of psychological deal that the previous generations made. And that deal was, you know, raise our standard of living, give us decent incomes, and we won't be concerned about politics. We won't object to your corruption. We won't object to the lawlessness. They're young enough to be idealistic, and they're young enough also not to remember the kind of hardship that the country endured during the 1990s. And as a result, they don't want any part of this bargain, many of them. They want a better future without this kind of massive corruption. And that's what we're seeing.
And what role is social media playing? It would seem to me that on the surface, these kids seem to know about the rest of the world, and they know that they're not getting what a lot of other young kids around the world are getting, particularly in the first world, if you will. And I don't know. I mean, we know that Navalny, the opposition leader who's going to be running against Putin, was arrested and wasn't able to attend these demonstrations. But he has been very skillfully using social media and YouTube, etc. And it seems like that's had an effect, and that these videos he's gotten out that are very amusing and very clever, showing and detailing the level of corruption at the highest levels of the government, including Medvedev, the prime minister, seem to be having an effect.
And former president, by the way.
Yeah,
indeed, this is true, because we have to bear in mind that television, which was and still is the principal source of information for most Russians, is heavily censored. So the video that was put on YouTube by Navalny about the corruption of Dmitry Medvedev under no circumstances appeared on national television. But through the social media, it received a national audience. So the the regime definitely has a problem. It can control information only up to a point. There now are alternative channels, and for young people, those channels are extremely important.
So where are we heading? I mean, it's a very strange coincidence that you had these demonstrations, and it was, of course, a national holiday, and you had all kinds of groups of people celebrating, and then suddenly all these kids show up, and then the cops, the riot police show up and really crack down on them. But this coincided with Showtime showing the first episode of Oliver Stone's four-hour series of interviews with Putin, which was broadcast last night, and it will be broadcast today, tomorrow, and on Thursday. So they, of course, none of the issues that the kids were demonstrating about were brought up in the interview so far with Putin. So what's your sense then of how Putin himself is dealing with this? Do you think he's feeling the heat? Because it's not that easy to beat up young...
He is very worried because he was the regime was very worried when the demonstrations over the falsification of elections in 2011 took place. And they reacted with repressive measures. And then those demonstrations seemed to peter out. They were followed by massive popular demonstrations in Ukraine. And those demonstrations inspired the invasion of Ukraine, including and the seizure of Crimea. But the question was for many people, will demonstrations begin again in Russia? Or have the Russians permanently accepted a situation in which they're ruled by a lawless clique? And in fact, I think what we're seeing is the demonstrations are beginning again, and they're going to be difficult to contain.
And again, I'm speaking with David Satter, who's written about Russia for almost four decades. He's a senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and his previous books include Darkness at Dawn, and his latest book is The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. And he has an article in today's Wall Street Journal, From Russia with Chaos. And do you think, though, that I'd like to get your comments on what's happening now. And of course, we had testimony today from Jeff Sessions on the ongoing Russian inquiry. And when a former FBI director who was fired by Trump.
Trump Russia scandal, basically, or the Trump Russia inquiry. It's of course, I'm expecting that this is going to go on for months, especially now that we have a special prosecutor. But what I notice as someone who studies Russia rather than the United States is just how flimsy the basic accusation is. The basic accusation is that Trump and his campaign colluded with Russian intelligence to defeat Hillary Clinton in the election. That's very unlikely to have happened. There's no proof of that. But more to the point, it's inconsistent with the way in which Russia operates. They probably did not have much concern about the identity of the next president. What they wanted to do was create chaos in the U.S. for whoever became the next president. That's why, on the one hand, they hacked the emails of the Democratic National Committee, and on the other hand, they created a dossier, which I believe was phony, about Trump. They generally work through third parties. They like to achieve their objectives with the hands of others. And WikiLeaks is a perfect example of that. It's highly unlikely that Julian Assange understood that he was being manipulated by the Russians. He probably thought that he was acting independently, because that's the way the Russians generally work. They try to make people believe that they're acting on their own. But that kind of operation, it was true, by the way, of Soviet support for the terrorist groups in the 1980s, but that kind of operation doesn't permit the kind of minute-by-minute coordination that's being alleged in the case of the Trump campaign and in relation to the 2016 election. So there are many things here that that need to be examined, and we need to have the investigation. We need to get to the bottom of it. But is it likely that at the end of the day we're going to see a conspiracy between Trump and Russian intelligence, or between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence? On the basis of the evidence so far, it's very unlikely.
Well, but what I wanted to ask you, though, David Satter, is that Comey, in his recent testimony, was dismayed that Donald Trump has never shown any interest in the Russian situation. Not the investor. He's very concerned about how it affects him personally, but he doesn't give a damn, it appears, about the fact that the Russians manipulated the election, which all of our intelligence communities have come to consensus to believe happened, and they believe it was directed by Putin. And to take that example further, the Senate today just made a bipartisan deal that they would take Russian sanctions out of Donald Trump's hands. And, you know, they're crafting this deal to impose new sanctions on Russia. So how do you explain Trump? He's never said a bad word about Russia.
Donald Trump has not expressed an interest in Russia was doing in his conversations with Comey. That doesn't mean that he wasn't taking an interest in those operations as a whole. I mean, he's undoubtedly been briefed on those on Russian cyber attacks. Because he's spoken about them, and he spoke in December about them, in which he said that the information that was provided to him convinced him that, in fact, the Russians had hacked the Democratic National Committee. So the fact that he hasn't discussed it with Comey doesn't mean he hasn't discussed it. And the reality is that Comey has done a number of things. We're getting into the details of the investigation that really are not well known to a lot of people. Comey, for example, made a statement that the purpose of the hacking was to defeat Hillary Clinton because Putin hates and fears Hillary Clinton. Well, where does that statement, hate and fears Hillary Clinton, come from? It comes from the Trump dossier. And who created the Trump dossier? The Russian intelligence. And Comey repeated that, you know, uncritically. May simply be that Trump doesn't have confidence in Comey. There are many things here. You know, when we have to be a little bit. I think what's happening and what people need to understand is that we're in a state right now in American society in which neither of the sides are ready to evaluate evidence objectively. And under those circumstances, the Russians have, you know, endless opportunities to feed disinformation and to create internal conflict in the U.S., and that's exactly what they're doing.
Well, just in closing, though, I have not heard that categoric statement before that the Russians created the dossier. It was always assumed that a former MI6 Russian specialist, Christopher Steele, created the dossier.
Ian, it was his sources. I mean, I've written about this in the Wall Street Journal this morning, and I recommend that you take a look. And also, I've written about it. There are articles by me in the internet analyzing the dossier. He has 15 to 20 sources, many of them in Russian intelligence, and all of them connected to Russian intelligence. Christopher Steele, in and of himself, 20 years outside of Russia, is incapable of creating anything. He's capable of feeding information that is fed to him. And as the former acting CIA director Michael Morell said, the evidence now is that he paid those sources and he never talked to them directly. So this is why, you know, there's so much information coming out, and it's so, you know, it requires so much knowledge, and the headlines are so superficial that people are acting on their emotions. I mean, if you look at the Trump dossier, it's to a trained eye, it's a product of Russian intelligence fed to Steele so that he can feed it to the Clinton campaign, just as they were feeding information to WikiLeaks.
Well, David Satter, tell our audience where the article is and what its title is in the Wall Street Journal.
Well, first of all, take a look at what I've written this morning in the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. And then take a look at what I wrote entitled, The Trump Dossier is a Russian Provocation, on National Review Online.
Okay.
And both of those articles are available on the internet. And if anyone has any questions, you and I can talk later and go into them and go answer them in detail.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, all the best.
All the best. And again, I've been speaking with David Satter, who has written about Russia for almost four decades. He's a senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and his previous books include Darkness at Dawn, and his latest book is The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep, Russia's Road to Terror and Dictatorship Under Yeltsin and Putin. And he has an article in today's Wall Street Journal, From Russia with Chaos. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back joined by the writer-director of a new film starring Brad Pitt, War Machine.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
This is a war we can After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now in the studio is David Michaud, who is a film director, screenwriter, producer, and actor, best known for directing the critically acclaimed 2010 film Animal Kingdom and the 2014 film The Rover. He is the writer and director of the new film War Machine, starring Brad Pitt, now out on Netflix and in theaters in Los Angeles and New York. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Michaud.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I guess, you know, particularly in the Trump era, in terms of art imitating life, it's pretty hard to catch up or keep up with life because you keep getting thrown.
Yeah, I've given up trying.
And, of course, today, in testimony before the Armed Services Committee, Senator McCain asked the Secretary of Defense General Mattis about Afghanistan. And Mattis was actually quite blunt, and surprisingly so, saying we're not winning and that we'll present a new strategy in mid-July. So there's a real kind of Groundhog Day feeling to your movie, and there's also a Groundhog Day feeling to the moment we are with Afghanistan. In other words, more troops, a new strategy, but the same war, which happens to be the longest war in American history.
Yeah, and it's interesting, right, when that admission of the fact that we're not winning presents as a kind of like a kind of statement of realist humility or something, but always underneath that, always following that statement is, but here's what we're going to do different that will win it, you know, which is effectively like yet another representation of the delusion that is at the center of the movie. That's basically in effect what the movie's about.
But it's pretty courageous, though, to take on the sacred cows, because we're at a time in this country where the military is about the only institution that people still respect. Obviously, politicians, I think the House and Senate have something like an 8% rating of approval. Mm. And one wonders who those 8% are, frankly. Mm-hmm. But how did you navigate that, though, because of the sense that you're dealing with a sacred cow?
Well, I mean, in two different ways. The first is that it wasn't always a sacred cow. You know, this is something that's peculiar to the last, say, you know, 15, 16, 17 years. I mean, basically post 9/11. But, you know, America has a long and rich history of war satire, you know, which I think grew out of a time when the military and the society that it serves were more deeply enmeshed, you know, mm-hmm. that it was open for criticism and for parody because it was of the people. And now that we have this separation between the military classes and the society, we have, you know, a volunteer standing army that exists in almost in a kind of isolation. It this constant, the very fact that Afghanistan is the longest running war in American history, that so much money has been spent, but more importantly, that so many lives have been lost, and that for the vast bulk of at least the commentariat in America, but also just the middle classes in general, that, you know, that they have so little actual personal involvement with that military, that their way of assuaging that guilt is right. to treat the military with nothing but deference.
And because they treat we don't have a draft, you mean? We don't have the draft anymore.
Because you don't have a draft, and because also the military has kind of functioned over the last however many decades to almost consciously separate itself from the society. You know, I mean, West Point, for instance, functions as an institution that almost encourages a kind of separation of the military classes from the society that it serves, you know. And so as a result, you know, we're sending these young men and women over to Afghanistan. Many of them die. Many of them are really horribly wounded. And, you know, and we owe them a debt of respect. What has happened, though, is that that debt of respect has extended to the entire institution. And as a consequence, nobody is asking questions of the architects of this chaos, you know. And again, that was I knew that I would be walking into strange, murky waters with this movie, but it felt, I not only felt like I could, but I felt like I should. I felt like somebody needed to be making some form of, you know, kind of popular artistic statement that asks questions of military leaders.
And again, David Michaud is joining us in the studio. He's a film director, screenwriter, producer, and actor best known for directing the critically acclaimed 2010 film Animal Kingdom and the 2014 film The Rover. He is the writer and director of a new film, War Machine, starring Brad Pitt, now out on Netflix and in theaters in Los Angeles and New York. I don't know whether you ever knew this old friend of mine who was America's most decorated living soldier. He unfortunately died from Agent Orange, Colonel David Hackworth. He actually retreated to Australia after the Vietnam War.
Yeah, I know his son, weirdly. His son's a filmmaker.
Yeah, that's right. So Hack was, you know, he used to refer to or rail against the generals and also against the kind of corporatization of the military. He used to refer to them as ticket punchers and perfume princes and always made the dichotomy between the toys and the boys, the toys being the military-industrial complex and the boys being the people whose lives are put on the line.
Yeah.
And I got the feeling that that's pretty much the subtext of your film, that some machine is driving the war machine. That's why, presumably, that's the title of the film.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, the thing that it had intrigued me, I mean, I had been researching this movie, the idea of making a movie in one of these modern theaters of war for a while, and I had originally thought that it would probably be something that was about the horror and the sadness and the trauma of the battlefield. It wasn't until Dee Dee Gardner and Jeremy Kleiner at Brad's company, Plan B, brought me Michael Hastings' book, The Operators, that I suddenly started to see a larger movie. I found my way in. It was about a movie that was about the, you know, to whatever extent is possible in 2 hours, a kind of, you know, the entire machine, the whole system. Because what, the question that I kept wanting to ask, I kept asking myself when I was researching the film was, how is it any of this stuff possible? How is it that we are still there? And that coming up to 16 years now, and to someone like me who has no military background, who has just, this, you know, who a number of years ago decided to start looking at this stuff, you know, it seems obvious and inevitable that there is no tangible victory around the corner. How is it then that we're still there? What is it that fuels this kind of constant perpetual war machine? Mm-hmm. And then it was in Michael's book that I started to get a sense of what the answers might be, and that they lay in the kind of ambition and vanity and career aspiration and hubris of those men running the war, you know, almost, and in a kind of conga line, you know, they'd get in there, they'd be there for a year or 2 years or something, and they'd drop off the edge, and then the next one had come along, and all of them were kind of there to realize, in a sense, their career aspirations. And there's a whole world of other people on the ground who are paying the price for that.
And what do you think happened, though, in the sense that we're no longer required to win wars. We haven't won a war since World War II. And yet Einstein's definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome. And that's pretty much the context of this discussion, given today's news from General Mattis, saying we're not winning, but we're going to come up with a new strategy as of mid-July and throw a bunch more soldiers at this obviously failed situation. As well, let's call it what it is, the graveyard of empires.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, again, these are the kinds of questions I was asking myself when I was researching the thing. I mean, you get the one thing that does seem peculiar to the military is this inability to look at situations outside the framework of victory and defeat or success and failure, you know. And, you know, in order to not keep making these same mistakes over and over and over requires somebody and somebody high up and very important in a position of power to admit failure, you know. And that's, you know, it's that...
Well, you're not going to get that from Donald Trump.
You're not going
to
get that.
The buck does not stop here on his desk. And I must say, I find it quite obscene that he's a kind of reality TV star that only cares about himself and his own ego. And I don't know whether you saw yesterday, it was like a North Korean cabinet meeting where he had everybody in his cabinet saying how wonderful he was. And he then ended up agreeing with everybody that he is wonderful. But no mention of the three young kids that died in Afghanistan. By the way, I think all of them probably were about between 6 and 10 years old when 9/11 happened.
Yeah, it's terrifying. Yeah. It's terrifying generally that this is now, you know, that not only is, you know, this war, specifically this war in Afghanistan is coming up to 16 years now, but that, you know, it has now spread into a whole bunch of other countries, that it has happened so insidiously and so steadily that it's almost not even newsworthy anymore. And we are now seeing kids who are, you know, probably getting very close to graduating high school, who don't know an America that isn't at war. That it almost becomes a given that the country of their birth is just always at war somewhere in the world, and that's just, you know, that is scary. That's not
right. Well, particularly, as you pointed out earlier, that it doesn't affect the rest of the society. We're sort of insulated. It's only the military community that deals with it because we don't have a draft. I'm told by my intel sources that the big shoe that's going to drop in Afghanistan is a coup against the current leader, who's pretty feckless, Ghani, probably by the warlords. And this will really, you know, as much as Mattis is trying to come up with a new strategy, the whole architecture, the ground could move right from under us because of our so-called partners there. And in your movie, of course, Ben Kingsley plays Karzai, and you can't help but laugh. I mean, talk about, you know, the difficulty of satirizing somebody that is really almost beyond absurd. The whole family were a bunch of crooks.
Yeah, I mean, and he is. I mean, you know, I'm not unaware of the fact that, you know, both, you know, in a way, the most absurd characters in the movie, and, you know, it's a tonally schizophrenic movie. I'm very, you know, there is a very clear and uncomfortable split between the absurdity of the executive level in all departments and the kind of the brutality and the trauma of what happened, the consequences that are felt on the ground. The two most absurd characters in the movie are Brad's, the general, and Hamid Karzai.
Yeah.
That almost, you know, to exemplify in some way that sense of whatever it is that's happening the top, at the executive level, that's trickling, finding its way of trickling down to the ground, is so absurd.
Right.
Is in essence, in a way, kind of feckless and almost unbelievable. You know, it required creating characters in Kingsley and in Brad that are kind of caricatures by design.
Right. Well, from my recollection of McChrystal, I don't think he was married, was he?
Yeah.
He was married? Yeah. Oh, because that's an amazing relationship that you have there. It's so painful. It's the marriage where nobody touches anybody.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I made a decision really early on when I started writing the screenplay for this thing that I wanted to change characters' names, in part because I wanted creative freedom to just, I just wanted the wiggle room.
Right.
In part because I didn't want to suggest that, you know, because I'm not privy to the conversations that Stan McChrystal might have had with his wife, you know, right. but I wanted to feel free to create characters that sure. were of my own invention.
Right.
But also because I didn't want to suggest that these, the events of this movie were somehow peculiar to Stan McChrystal. You know, it's like the movie for me is about the machine and about that constant repetition of the machine, such that, you know, when I listen to James Mattis talk, you know, I read a really fascinating piece on him in The New Yorker not long ago. You know, I go, wow, on a certain level, the specifics of the events aside, you could transplant him into this movie. And I was hearing the same voices that were in my head when I was writing the screenplay for this one.
Well, of course, the ending, I don't know whether I should give it away, but the ending says that, doesn't it, in the sense?
Yeah, it's a circularity of you know, like I say, almost like kind of watching lemmings climb a ladder and then fall off the top and the next one thinks he's going to do it different, you know?
Right. But some of the characters now, I actually knew Dick Holbrook. He seems like he's the diplomat, right? Is that?
There's a mash of guys in there. Those characters that are played by Alan Ruck and Griffin Dunn and Nicholas Jones. You know, there was all sorts of Eikenberries and Holbrooks and stuff floating around in there.
And then what about General Pulver being Mike Flynn? Is that a reach or is that?
No, there was a couple of guys in McChrystal's orbit who were consolidated into that character. But, Mike Flynn was a big one. We had no idea at the time that he would be so newsworthy. I mean, I remember I was editing the film and Michael Hastings' widow, Elise Jordan, sent me an email saying, you're not going to believe this, but Mike Flynn is acting as Donald Trump's foreign affairs advisor. This was back during the primaries. I was like, oh, wow, that's weird. And then it's only gotten weirder and weirder since.
Well, of course, you know, what happened to Michael Hastings, the Rolling Stones journalist who broke the story, who's the narrator in your film and wrote the book, The Operators, from which the film is based, he came to an extraordinary end, I must say. Obviously something that you couldn't deal with, but still some people have questions about that, by the way. So in terms of, I mean, I must say, I'm sort of reminded every time we talk about it. And I, by the way, I try to cover this story for years and years and 16 years. And one part of it that is even more surreal is that you can make the case, and the intelligence people and the military people do make this case, that every American that's died in Afghanistan and the 20,000, about 2,500 have died, 20,000 plus have been wounded, more often than not losing limbs because of the IEDs, that all of that blood is on the hands of the Pakistanis. And the Pakistanis, you know, the joke about Pakistan is it's not a country with an army, but an army with a country. And yet our State Department is completely blind. They deal with the civilian government, which is pointless, and ignore the mendacity of the military government. And they, you know, the latest thing I did the other day was a report on the bombing that took place in front of the German embassy. Immediately, Afghan intelligence attributes it to the Haqqani network, which is entirely controlled by the ISI, Pakistan's intelligence service. So on top of the absurdity that you've brought to the table in your film, there is also this sort of geopolitical absurdity. Again, it's a bit like Einstein. You know, we keep doing the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's really such a tragedy. And you know, I'm reminded of Rudyard Kipling's, you know, when you're wounded and left on Afghanistan's plains and the women come out to cut up what remains, just roll to your rifle and blow out your brains and go to your God like a soldier.
Yeah, it's a graveyard of empires, that's for sure. I mean, yeah, it's a little bit of a stretch to suggest that, you know, that somehow the blood of all of these people who have died, these young Americans that have died, is somehow on the hands of the Pakistanis. You know, it's like, you know.
Right, it's a bit inflammatory, I agree.
And it's also just we know on a certain level that what is happening is that this war in Afghanistan is actually a war that should probably be fought somewhere else, you know.
Right.
That you're dealing with principally a kind of a giant ethnic group that stretches across Afghanistan and into Pakistan, in that, you know, across the Durand line. I mean, that was drawn up by the British at the end of the 19th century. I mean, everything in a way that we're dealing with in both in Afghanistan, in South Asia, and in the Middle East is a product of Western meddling in these parts of the world for hundreds of years.
Right.
And it's all coming back to bite us now, you know.
Right.
And yet, and what is it? What's our answer? It's to keep meddling even more. You know, when finally we've found that we've dug ourselves into a deep hole, our answer seems to be to call for more shovels.
And again, Kipling, what was it? About the tombstone drear, here lies a fool who tried to hustle the East. You know? So, well, just in closing, though, by the way, I read a really good review of the film by a general who's a retired general at American University, who feels that it's a really important lesson for the military. Do you get any sense of that, that they shouldn't be participating? And I mean, I don't mean to let the military off the hook in the sense of blaming everyone on the Pakistan military's duplicity or the ISI. As the film makes clear and our conversation makes clear, it's the people that send these boys and girls off to die that should be held accountable. And what's your sense of whether that would ever happen?
Well, I mean, it depends what you mean by accountable. What I think is important, you know, if the film were able to achieve anything, you know, I like hearing that it is being reviewed by generals or retired generals or whatever, that sense that I'm getting that, I mean, it's really strange. The movie has landed in a really strange way in the world, you know. It's because of the new landscape we're in terms of the way films are exhibited and everything. It's kind of strange. It's like, you know, there's a certain part of me that feels like it's gotten a bit lost.
Right.
But I found it incredibly gratifying to hear that it is being talked about in those circles that are important to me. And I, you know, because it would cause me great sadness to feel like the film just disappeared entirely. Because I said at the beginning, you know, I'm sitting here as an Australian, and so on a certain level, I still nonetheless feel like I am in a position to comment on the role that the U.S. military plays in the world. In part because, you know, wherever the U.S. military goes, we follow eagerly with our little tails wagging, you know, and have done ever since, in every conflict since World War One. But also because I think generally, I think we owe it to those men and women on the ground to not only thank them for their service, but to ask questions of their leaders, because those leaders work for us. I actually do firmly believe they need to be held to account, but it needs to start now. We need to start talking about it in terms other than those of just pure reverence or deference. You know?
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, David Michaud.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with David Michaud, who's a film director, screenwriter, producer, and actor best known for directing the critically acclaimed 2010 film Animal Kingdom and the 2014 film The Rover. He is the writer and director of the new film War Machine, starring Brad Pitt, now out on Netflix and in theaters in L.A. and New York. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.